Right, we're back, and just a program note that back-to-back Barrys, that's us, we'll be conducting a live event at this year's Sydney Writers Festival. It'll be a breakfast recording of the program. It'll be on Thursday, May 21, so you can go to the Sydney Writers Festival website for bookings. We got an email this week from Philip Orgill, who starts out by saying that he enjoys the program and he thinks we're two very articulate and informed presenters, Tony, and that he likes the fact that you update polling stats. It's a magic combo. I don't know why we chose his email, but here's the point. He says that he and his wife have had 17 years in the Middle East, and he has friends in the UAE and in Tehran, and he's also a boomer, and he agrees with last week's comments on the United States interventions over the years in international conflicts. And I just like that coming from him, from someone who's lived in the region, that he sees parallels with this particular experience. Dennis Richardson, his decision to quit. It's the background of this needs to be kind of pointed out, that he was appointed to head up a review specifically into the intelligence services and whether they might have made errors in the run-up to the terrorism attack at Bondi. He was appointed at a time when the government was still resisting a Royal Commission. And then the Royal Commission was established and the idea was to fold Dennis Richardson into that. What happened from then on was a failure in process, undoubtedly a failure in process, that it either didn't occur to them or they didn't think they needed to deal with the fact that there were questions around that. What if Dennis Richardson makes his own findings, his own recommendations by April? That was his deadline. What happens to those? Will they stand the test of time? Will they be released at the interim report? Well, apparently they had these internal discussions and the Royal Commission had decided that there wouldn't be recommendations and findings in the interim report. You can understand why that would have frustrated him, because, as he said, he was now surplus to requirements, that he felt like a researcher. And, you know, those findings now, he obviously felt there was a sense of urgency about them. And now there's even a question as to whether they would survive the whole legal process that is to come with the Royal Commission. And 7 or 8 months from now, they could disappear. So you can understand his frustrations around that. It was all poorly handled in that sense.
Yeah, Paul Sakal broke that story this week about the Royal Commission resisting, Virginia Bell resisting his recommendations at this point. Dennis Richardson, I think it's worth noting, is one of the more respected and celebrated public servants in Australia by both sides. In fact, Kevin Rudd appointed him as the head of DFAT when he was Prime Minister, and as we know, that is Kevin Rudd's passion project, his foreign affairs, so that's not something he would have done without weeks of thought. But he's held in incredibly high regard, and I think that's one of the reasons why Albanese appointed him straight away, because he thought this is somebody who both sides respect enormously and won't be causing any sort of conflict in the media about his appointment. So it was a huge move for him to resign. I think he did it as neatly as possible and as professionally as he possibly could. But the briefing coming out to Paul Sakal was pretty telling.
Yeah, I think when you say how he handled it afterwards, there would have been a danger that to walk away from something like this would be seen as a bit churlish. Mm. But he went out there and did a lot of media.
Yep.
In a single day, he stood up there and took all the questions and was quite frank. Look, I have to declare an interest. I worked with Dennis Richardson one stage. I've socialised with Dennis Richardson. And what I know of him is that like when he gave up full-time work 8 or 9 years ago, he probably didn't really know what lay ahead, but he's taken lots of responsibilities like this. He's the sort of person that if the Prime Minister phones up and wants something done, he would say yes. You know, he'd feel a kind of an obligation to do it. So it would have been a big step for him to step away as he did. The robo-debt, I guess, final finding, the National Anti-Corruption Commission, they had 6 people referred to it for examination. One of them was Scott Morrison, as it turned out. He was cleared. 2 public servants, it was found, were engaged in serious corrupt conduct, but there won't be any prosecution around that. But I just want to say about that the government did pursue hundreds of thousands of people. In fact, the figures are 470,000. That's almost 500,000 people were wrongly issued with debt notices and were repaid in full. And another 200,000 were still under review, or they had that review waived. And it just seems to me the language used around it at the time, that it was a strike force, they were going to aggressively target fraud. And when people received these notices, a lot of them had no idea of what it was, the money that was owed. They had no knowledge of it. They were astonished and they were traumatised and they didn't know how to deal with it. So it just seems to me in the end that no corruption on the part of any of the politicians involved, but I think it's fair to say it was unforgivable and morally reprehensible. It was driven by a massive indifference to those who were affected and impacted, and also I think driven by an obsession to exploit the so-called welfare cheats issue. We should never forget it.
But I think what concerns me the most about that report this week is that the likes of Alan Tudge had his reputation shredded, and quite rightly so. On a number of different issues, he's had his reputation shredded. But the two public servants referred to in that report, where they said there was evidence of corruption, I mean, they should be hauled before courts, because there is a real question mark there. I think, you know, for listeners who don't know, these departments receive all sorts of pitches of, you know, from private companies with software ideas that, you know, and RoboDebt was obviously one of those ways to capture, you know, money that was perceived to be wrongly paid. And public servants make an assessment and then recommend it to the minister, and the minister, the buck stops at the minister, and they've had their reputation shredded. But there's real question marks as to the role of the public servants in this. And I'm very disappointed that the commission hasn't progressed that forward.
Yeah, but the finding wasn't that the public servants had been unfair. The allegation was that they knew what they were doing was illegal, and it went ahead anyway. Well, that's it for this week. Just a reminder that we will be at the Sydney Writers' Festival on Thursday, May 21. So you can look that one up. This podcast was made on the sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri people. It was produced by Charisma Luthria and Joe Koenig, and video production, Burton Nguyen.
The executive producer is Hannah Parks.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry. And this is Back to Back Barry's Guardian Australia podcast.